Aren't they already monetizing on people's failures?
I think that's true. What would you pay, Julian, if this were the case, to insure this? How much would you put up as a deposit?
Me?
Yeah. How much do you would you really pay for this?
For what? To ensure I don't fail on Coursera?
Like, it's a commitment device to learn game design theory. How much are you willing to pay for that? How much are you willing to, like,
I think you have to pay me, I guess, not to fail. Wait, oh, which way around?
Let's start with utility. I don't understand what it even means.
Everybody has some kind of utils in their head that they're calibrating.
There's hardly anything that hasn't been used for money.
In fact, there may be a fundamental problem in modeling what I want to model.
Episode 37, returning guest. Returning guest,
Woo!
I think. Is this our only returning guest? I think we've had one other, right?
No, this is the first one.
My God, Julian.
Wow.
Julian, welcome back
You
to the
must be a
cast.
special man.
You're back in business. You've got a new paper we're going to talk about today. Hot takes everywhere.
Okay, fair. Good.
What have you been up to since we last saw you?
Not much, same old. Doing research, teaching, a little bit of advisory work.
You're going up to GDC next month?
Yes, I am. We're going to organize a mini summit on revenue optimization in games on March 19th.
You had some celebrities. You had Yuse there.
Yeah,
Yost,
he's going to
excuse
be here
me.
again. He's going to join again.
He was there. Brett Novak, who I work with, who's really smart about product, was there talking about some theories that have like really held up over the last year. You can ask, there's a Q&A section. You can heckle. You gave a talk. Are you giving a talk
Yes.
this year?
Yeah, I'm going to actually give a joint talk with Yost.
Oh.
Ooh, interesting. A little collaboration work, a little co-publishing going on back
Well, yeah,
there. What are
so
you
I don't
guys?
know if you saw we published Harvard Business Review article together in November on games as media to build relationships with customers.
I vaguely remember seeing that.
Yes. We'll post a, how about we post a link to it in the show notes?
Good. Yeah, let's do it. So, anyways, yeah, Yo started writing on that piece after GDC last year, actually. And then November, it finally came out. And then, yeah, we're going to give the talk together this year, actually drawing on that article quite a bit.
Is academia buying any of this shit? Since you've published all your papers, are people buying into the price experiment results? Do they care about it in the context of games? Do they think it has no external validity? Has the agenda needle moved at all since we last chatted?
That's a good question. What's the agenda needle exactly?
I don't
My
know.
own agenda, or
There's Mario at one end, and there's like macroeconomic inflation business cycle at the other.
okay, yeah,
Are we closer to Mario these days? What's going on?
Probably more inflationary macroeconomics takes. No, girl, but I'd say I'm pretty excited, actually. I think marketing, which is my academic field, is slowly waking up to games, and there's more and more work being published, both empirical and theoretical, in management science and also in the top marketing journals. Pretty exciting stuff, actually. I'm also working with one of Chris Ryan. He's at UBC Sauder School of Business, and he has done some phenomenal theoretical work that came out in management science on level design and the likes. So I'm actually really excited for it. We shall see if it's going to move the needle. When it comes to the paper we discussed so much last time, I think the external validity point is always a difficult one that you have to convince reviewers of and editors. But this mechanism we pinpoint, this complementarity between the free version and the premium version, and that leads to this virtuous cycle, which makes price promotions quite profitable in the long run, counter to existing academic wisdom. I think that's convincing people. And I've actually, also talked to academics about that repeatedly.
Is the narrative for marketers for me, the narrative when I'm trying to sell games to economists has always been like experimentation. Oh, you can study human behavior in these online environments. Is it similar in marketing, or is there a different angle?
Good questions. I think it's similar in some ways. Definitely consumer behavior and understanding that in games is super interesting. But the other thing is the marketing mix and actually understanding how strategically what firms can learn on a strategy level, like in terms of how to run games and what are like even applying the marketing mix to games is something that hasn't really been done. Actually, in the piece we want to discuss today, I'm trying to start doing that a little bit. For example, we just had a paper accepted at the International Journal of Research and Marketing that actually describes a dynamic difficulty adaptation system in a puzzle game. There, we also lean a little bit into the marketing mix. So it goes beyond like looking at consumer behavior and trying to understand what's actually possible on the product dimension of the marketing mix. Actually, sorry, I should start by quickly saying what the marketing mix is. That's a really long-standing concept in marketing scholarship, first conceived of in the 1950s by Neil
We'll have
Borden.
a link to your you had a podcast with Eric Seifert recently as well. That was a good one.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, always enjoying the podcast. And there was one where I went with Kuhn Powells also, right? The professor from
Mobile Research. Mobile Dev Memo.
Yeah. But anyway, so the marketing mix, long-standing concept introduced by Neil Borden, who was a professor at Harvard Business School, and it has in its canonical version 4 P's, price, promotion, product, and place. And even just spelling out what this means in the context of games and then understanding how does a dynamic difficulty adaptation system, which is clearly on the product dimension of the marketing mix, but how does it impact your ability to price and to run promotions, et cetera? I think there's so much work to be done that goes also beyond consumer behavior.
You used the 4 P's in the paper we're going to talk about today.
I'm trying to bring some marketing to gaming, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you say management science and level design?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Tell me about that. What's that?
So I said that in the context of Chris Ryan, who's a professor at UBC Sauder, and he's done some really interesting theoretical work. I think 2 or 3 of his papers were recently published in over the last 2 years, I believe, in management science. One is on level design and really building the theory for why many games have this mini boss, big boss design, right? Where you have a difficulty peak in the middle of the levels roughly, and then another one in the very end. And really trying to build up a theory behind that. Why is that? How games are designed? What can we learn from that, from virtual world design more broadly? Yeah, I think he does really interesting work in that space.
Is the implication that we should design like how we manage workers in a similar way? Like, how do they connect the dots here, yeah, between the game and the...
No, not at all, actually. It's not that. This is really interesting because this is, I think, the differences between academia and practice in some ways that may lead to that misunderstanding. Chris is an operations research scholar, right? And so they do optimization in all kinds of business settings. And so he's really developing theories for how games work from a business point of view. It's not really even about learning anything about how to compensate workers or anything of the sort. It's really more a theory piece squarely focused on games.
I've often thought about that, like, why do we create these fluctuations? So there's always the 3 acts of a player or whatever, right? And what is the theoretical basis for why, when you should have difficulty spikes and moments of relaxation and whatnot? What have you been playing? Are you playing any games lately?
Got a selection of good things on sale, stranger.
You talk about your work. What do you do in your free time?
Actually, I've been moving around a lot. So it skews pretty heavily mobile at the moment. I just moved to Chicago to start a new job at Northwestern Medill. Yeah, it skews heavily mobile. Even though I just downloaded Steam again on a Windows laptop I got, but haven't really done anything with that yet. But one thing I did is I started playing Legendary Game of Heroes again recently. That's a game I worked on a lot, actually, a few years ago.
At Network?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
With Eric Seaver? Did you work with Ethan Levy, too?
Yes, I did.
Oh, wow. What's this game?
Legendary Game of Heroes.
Puzzle RPG. Squad RPG with a match mechanic layered.
Oh, cool. Reminds me of Puzzle and Dragons.
The Legend of the Legendary Heroes?
Yep. I think it's a phenomenal game. And anyways, I just downloaded it and played it again from the beginning just to see how it had evolved. I think that's pretty cool when you've worked on a game like, whatever, 3 to 5 years ago and then seeing what it has developed into. I'd say a lot is actually quite similar, but there's new nuances and overall, I'd say a more mature experience.
How do you feel looking back at your baby? Do you look at it and be like, oh, like, I can't believe they changed this thing I loved? Or is it more, oh, like, it's grown up and become its own thing?
So I wouldn't say it's not my baby, right? It's the game designer's baby.
Your nephew, I don't know.
Yeah, I was doing data science on it, so we're more the offer targeting and those sorts. It's cool to see, and yeah, it just feels, it's still super fun. Some other games I'm playing is Agent Hunt. Nobody will know that. It's just a pretty scrappy shooter where you sniper, and yeah, it's just fun sometimes when you have a few minutes. Blow off some steam.
Agent Hunt,
yes. It's cool. Not a great game, but check it out.
It's fun, it's a good game.
Yeah, fair. And then Fruit Ninja, actually. I'm playing Fruit Ninja again. That's the first mobile game I've ever played back in the day, or played in depth, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's so fun. I was like actually thinking, what if there would be an opportunity maybe to pick the game mechanic back up, maybe in a different, combined with a different meta game. I've also started a class actually on game design on Coursera recently. I realized I've been working in games for so many years and I've never actually taken a class in game design. So I felt like that was a little overdue.
You got to report back to us. I want to know what they're teaching us, like the theory of game design. Like, I've always imagined it's just a hodgepodge of like social science. And like then some conjecture is like my understanding, but I would love to be proven wrong. I don't think I've ever read, Ralph Costner has published a little bit. He's literally published A Theory of Fun, but I feel like a lot of it hasn't been formalized. You know, there's textbooks, but I don't consider a textbook a formalization.
Well, there's definitely no models, no mathematical models, but there are a bunch of books that are pretty well agreed upon. It's like the
A theory is enough. Like Costner, I think is enough. I just wish there was
more. I read A Theory of Fun. I wasn't super convinced by it. His main thesis there is the fun is in the learning, which I think is true. I think many games are fun from you encounter a new mechanic, you figure out how it works, you learn how to use it, and you feel like good for learning how to use it and overcome some challenge. But there's also a lot of games that don't fit that mold at all, and he like fails to account for them.
Yes, and I would say in this class, it's actually very applied. I'm not very far into it, but they more start from the design point of view, like almost like maybe design thinking or whatever, but you start by actually very quickly making your own game. And I think that's a nice way of teaching it because I deal with theory and like advanced stuff all the time anyway. This is actually nice for a change to do something hands-on a little bit.
That's cool. So do they have you like making game prototypes or is it like a course project or something like that?
To be honest, I'm currently overdue on my first homework, which would be to make a very simple game, just like drawing it out on a sheet of paper. And I haven't done that yet. Yeah, I'll need to circle back.
Can I pitch you on an experiment for Coursera? Because this is always what happens in Coursera. Like, I'm sure if you look at the Coursera retention curves, they're fucking awful. And I also think there's an interesting point that like these MOOCs have just fallen off. But why can't they do the thing where you put down $100 and they refund you after you get like certain grades as a commitment device? Like, I feel like people would do that and they could monetize on people's failures.
Aren't they already monetizing on people's failures?
I think that's true. What would you pay, Julian, if this were the case to insure this? How much would you put up as a deposit?
Me?
Yeah. How much would you really pay for this?
For what? To ensure I don't fail on Coursera?
Like it's a commitment device to learn game design theory. How much are you willing to pay for that? How much are you willing to like...
I think you have to pay me, I guess, not to fail. Wait, oh, which way around?
So you give them $100 and you say, if I complete the course, I get $100 back. Otherwise, I lose it.
Yes, that'd be nice. Oh, yeah, that's like a piggy bank. But
capital means a stronger commitment because you've got more at risk.
That's an interesting one.
But it also means that you're likelier to have a higher completion rate because you don't want to lose all that capital that's at risk. And you have real and strong autonomy over that, too.
Actually, yeah, it's true. There's tons of opportunities for gamification of that sort. I don't know if anybody's doing that, but...
I think there's a reverse model here, which is you would calculate your hourly wage per additional unit of studying based on the amount of credit that you've put up, and then you would compare that against your relative opportunity costs, and then you'd pick the higher one. I think that's the strategy. So, like, you have to set it at high enough so that it crowds out your other opportunity cost. And you're a professor. You got a lot of shit going on.
You've completely lost it. Phil, what are you trying to do?
So what is the economic model for like you deciding to put up a deposit for Coursera?
Golden handcuffs, basically.
So what do you want to set the wage rate at or the amount of capital that you deposit? And I think you work backwards from once you've
Is there an interest rate?
If you want me to put in like an interest rate over.
So you put a deposit and if you don't finish, then you lose your money. Is that
correct?
Is it retention mechanic?
Right. But it works out to an hourly wage. Once you've committed the capital, you can now think of everything as an hourly wage because you're gaining back money by studying, right? You're earning your way back up to your deposit based on every hour of studying you do because it extends your retention, which means you're more likely to get a payout. Your expected value goes up.
Yeah, but you just spent the money. You'd be better off to just not do it in the first place. If there's any positive probability that you don't complete it, you would not do it. If you're rational.
Well, that just tunes down the expected probability, right?
Well,
I think the point is that you know that you're not rational, right? You know that you want to do this thing, but in the moment you'll be lazy. And so you're doing this to overcome your own behavioral biases.
Well, hold on. There's a rational model for this, obviously, which is like you've got the present self and like the past self. Have you heard of this model? So this is how you can maintain rationality in your view, Eric. Like you have the present self, which wants to commit to that, but your future self won't at like time T plus one. And so you're basically trying to bind your future self version
What, you got split personality disorder? That's how you solve for rationality here?
It's one of the ways we can build like an agent-based model around this. All right, we've gone off the reservation.
Hold on. Just one last thing on this is that if you think about it from the Coursera designer's perspective, there's a huge perverse incentive here to make the course artificially hard and like rob customers of their money, right?
Oh, if there's this sense. But what? It's not like the course instructor gets the excess money, right? That would be super fucked up.
No, I disagree. First of all, I do think they should get their wage rate, but I would argue that like they probably have more value in retention. Like they want you to get your capital back because I think that ultimately ensures long run retention on the platform. I feel like you can monetize off like
who gets
a 5%
the capital if you don't get it back? Where does it go?
Definitely,
that's a good question. Yeah,
because if it goes to Coursera, then there's going to be an incentive.
Maybe it goes to charity, and so then you know PETA. No one has an incentive to.
I'd be cool with that.
Anyway, there's a whole mechanism design problem here.
There's this paper, Paying Not to Go to the Gym, by, was it De La Vigne and Malmedier, and AR 2006. I think that'd be interesting in this context.
Yeah, there's probably that paper about picking your kids up from daycare and paying to delay. It's like you can pay $15 to pick them up. I don't remember the paper, but they did an experiment where they wanted to encourage people to pick up their kids on time. So they started charging them $5 for every like 15 minutes or something they were late.
Oh, the moral philosopher, Michael Sandel from Harvard.
Wow.
Sorry, go ahead.
You were able to stick with that. I didn't know the author. No, that's super helpful.
He references this story a bunch when he talks about he published this book called The Morality of Markets. And he references this story a lot as like, he's trying to show that introducing the market mechanic fundamentally changes the ethics. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it was probably a list paper, the original one, to be honest. But yeah, it's all of a sudden tardiness skyrockets because now you're paying for the privilege of, it's a commodity. It's no longer like a moral aggression to not pick your kid up on time. You're paying to pick your kid up later. So you're entitled to that because you're paying for it. Anyway. I disagree with Phil's take. I think that was insane.
But anyways, I wanted to mention one more game that I've been playing. Merge Mayor is a game by Berlin-based Starberry Games. That company was founded by people I worked with those in the past. It's always, I love seeing what other people... Has it been out forever? I played that game and I enjoyed it a lot. And I think it's pretty awesome to see what they're up to.
What are they up to?
Just like pretty good game elements. So like game design and good meta game design. And yeah. Good visual.
Let me hit you with one puzzle question before we get into your experimentation paper. Because I remember you published this old paper on Jelly Splash. And Jelly Splash, for people who aren't familiar, was like this old match game from Wooga. It was a linker, which is the core mechanic where you drag all the connecting pieces that are matched together. That's one of the ways you start the cascading process. And the thing that you had in that game was time-based gates. So like when you would consume X amount of levels, you would throttle players and you would put a time gate that they could pay to go over. I could consume 2 levels, then I get to the gate and I could either wait a day or get paid $1 to consume the next levels. Why do you think that model died out? Why is that not a persistent meta and match?
You mean the model of paywalling additional game content generally, or specifically like this waiting mechanic? Yeah.
Paywalling content in this way. That's a very interesting mechanic that you could apply that meta on single player games too, right? No one in single player does that, which I find curious. You could say, I'm going to give you X amount of time for free. And then if you get to the levels too quickly, I'm going to time gate you. I'm very curious about your explanation, but it's just, we haven't seen that meta taken off.
Can you clarify the mechanic? So if you finish level 1 really fast, you get to level 2.
I think it's inspired actually by what we've seen early in the days of news going into freemium, when different news providers started offering content online and they started introducing paywalls, right? So you get 10 articles for free and then you have to pay. So here it's a bit like you get to play 40 levels for free and then you need to pay to unlock the next tranche of levels. It was definitely in Jelly Splash back in the day. I don't actually know. It might still be in there, to be honest. There was a time when you could unlock and you could wait. You could unlock by inviting 3 friends or by paying 70 coins, which amounted to roughly $1, I think. And we did run experiments with that, what options are on offer there and so on. To be honest, I don't actually fully recall what we found, but why has it died out? I think actually it has died out because the more attractive, more elegant, more seamless way of monetizing goes back also to this management science paper we discussed. You rather introduce like severe peaks in difficulty and then make money from consumables that people use to boosters, whatever, special pieces and so on. It just feels probably a little more organic than having these paywall thingies. But it'd be super interesting to test this out, like, in a rigorous way, I think.
I could imagine you lose the tail if you cut everybody off at a specific level and you say you've got to churn or pay money. You probably end up with a meta where you have non-payers who just cycle from game to game versus maybe if you retain them for T more days, maybe they would have eventually converted or something like that.
You can multi-home almost, right? You can have multiple match three games going and rotate between the locked ones.
Yeah.
I think the missing link here is loss aversion and the discovery of win streaks. So most games are about win streak. I don't believe Jelly Splash ever had it. And so now it's all about making sure your win streak doesn't get hampered. And I think that actually combines really well with the peak difficulty we've been hinting at this whole episode. I completely agree with that theory. But I also think you've got to frame it like in psychology, honestly. Like that there are S-curves. We talk about S-curves all the time in system design, sigmoid curves. Like there is difficulty that peaks and then it slows down again, then it peaks up again. That also appears to be where match is also ramped. And I think that's also where win streaks fit in, because you can increase your win streaks. You can increase momentum. And not only that, you can provide skis. You can make everything go faster. So I think there's a lot that I'd be very interested in this operations paper, but I think you have to marry it to social theory that we've had for a while, which is flow state is this optimal period almost of human bliss that I don't think anyone else has taken seriously. I mean, to Eric's point, isn't there something that games has something, really does have something to say here about flow, like worker challenge, about utility theory? I feel like Jeremy Bentham and the utilitarian should be going like batshit crazy about games. I think we have way more to say about games than any fucking neuroscience bullshit, neuroeconomics bullshit that's been like propagated in the last fucking decade. That's like a research dead end, in my opinion.
I'm just curious, like when you say like the winning streaks that Jelly Splash didn't have, what do you mean exactly?
So like the whole theory of match right now is that as you have each consecutive win, you build up a booster that is applied on the next level. That booster is cumulative. So by win streak number three, you have win streak number one's benefit, win streak number two's benefit, and the win streak number three's benefit. And so if you were to lose a level, that means you're going to have to play at least three more attempts to build that up again. And so that becomes rather costly. And so now I'm going to spend gold to ensure that I win on the first attempt and I don't lose my win streak by buying extra moves or using boosters. And the extension of that, actually, I don't know. We should talk about this in relation to your experiment paper, because one of the things that you say in that paper is about disrupting the player experience, which we should talk about, because there's been a lot of like development in match that I think strikes at the heart of that I'd be interested to get your take about.
Sounds good.
Julian, can you tell us a little bit about the paper? It's entitled Experimentation in Gaming, an Adoption Guide. It looks like you've been floating it around. We're going to have a link to it in the show notes. But in your own words, what are you trying to do here?
Ryan Lucht over at APO and I were actually chatting at CODE. So that's the Conference on Digital Experimentation. That's at MIT each year, roughly October. I think last year it was October. And among other things, we're talking about how gaming companies actually run a ton of experiments and have pretty sophisticated experimentation programs that are really rich and advanced. Many people in other industries have no clue that's actually happening. It's really, for your point, Phil, I'd say that there's like many people outside of gaming don't know what's necessarily going on. And so Ryan invited me to write an overview article about experimentation in gaming for their learning platform that's called Outperform. It's like an experimentation learning platform. And I think the article on there is called Gaming Companies Run Thousands of Experiments a Year. Here's why and how. And when I started writing that, I asked Ryan specifically, do you want like a comprehensive piece that gives an overview and allows people to get a lay of the land? Or do you want with a punchline that's something clear, like a clear thing that sticks with people? And they wanted something comprehensive, so I went more this way, and it turned out way longer than I expected it would be. But I still don't cover nearly everything. I think it's a start, though, and I can't wait actually to talk with you about it, because I don't think there's a better crowd to talk about this paper with.
What do you hope, after this paper is disseminated, that people take away from it? I know it's a guide, but am I supposed to read this and then go out and be like, okay, here's where I am in the game development process, let me go through the guide and now generate some ideas based on the framework here?
That's one way. It could be you're running a game studio. You have a sense that you're maybe not, and you're like the general manager of it or whatever. You have a sense that you're maybe not using experimentation successfully yet, or that there's like untapped opportunities. You could dive into this and kind of use this to challenge your analytics team on what are they doing? What are we doing in these different areas where experimentation could be used? I think that's actually the main way I think about it. Or if you, even as an indie, if you're publishing a game and you want to understand where could I actually start using experiments, where, what would it even be used for, et cetera. Those are the kind of the audience I had in mind with this.
I like how you lay things out and you're like, I really like the perspective of, hey, where is experimentation relevant? Like, how can we improve the game and all that? I made a comment about, it seems like it's written from a marketer's point of view. And I think the thing that jumped out to me is you had this grid of the four Ps, right? Product, place, price, promotion. And then like the game dev phases, and you had this matrix. And like the bullet points in the matrix, for example, some of them like game production, that's build the whole game, but that's one bullet point. And like at that point, 80% of the dev resources, 80% of the man hours or labor costs or whatever are going towards building the game, like engineers, artists, QA. And then there's a bunch of bullets that are like a small thing that like a couple people in marketing or product might do, ad monetization, or like, maybe that's a big one, but, or like select tech stack, right? That's a huge thing that the game has to decide. What engine are we going to be on? What kind of integration are we going to have? Yeah. Anyway, that was all I meant by that, is that it seems like, if this grid is meant to be like, this matrix is not like evenly weighted, is all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, definitely not. So let's start with one thing. So one thing I distinguish in the paper that I'm not sure is very commonly done is like quantitative and qualitative experimentation. With qualitative experimentation, this idea that you very early on during prototyping or concept testing, you actually run the game, you have people play the game, and you just look for major effect sizes. You don't actually try to quantify any distribution or whatever. You just want to get that wow moment or see where people really struggle. You just look for massive effect sizes, not caring about uncertainty really around these effect sizes. And then quantitative experimentation is much more when you're in market.
Well, hold on, what's the experiment? What's the experiment? That's an optimization problem. What am I experimenting with?
So you could think about like in the core loop. I mean, I need to cook up some example, but it would be something around really fundamental to the game, to the core of the game design and the game's design, and where you maybe have two different hypotheses about what would resonate better with the market. So then you do a couple of play tests, let's say with five people for each of the different variants, and you just get a read from that. Do they struggle now? Do they complain? Are they like, oh, wow, this is amazing to play? And if you notice, yeah, does that make sense?
Just play testing. Right.
No, but I think there's, to Julian's point, this is something I don't see game designers do enough of. So here's, I don't see game designers set out with a playtesting theory every single week and say, I'm testing this theory, this playtest, right? It's about testing a new version of a build and then getting feedback and then optimizing the feature based on that feedback. But they aren't sitting there saying, what if I tuned this style to 80% on a Wednesday? It's about new feature incorporation. And I think Julian, like, I think being more methodological about, I'm going to tune this and tune that for exactly what Julian mentioned, which is massive effect sizes. Like, just start hitting fucking buttons until something interesting happens.
There's a thing about the Civ guy, who's Sid Meier. Yeah, who says that if you're going to crank these knobs in places, like, you really crank them. Basically, double them or cut them in half. If you're doing, like, a 10% change, you're not going to get the effect size. You're not going to notice in the playtest. To Julian's point, you're looking for these big effects on a small sample size, so you need to have big swings. Yeah,
exactly. And at that point, you don't have a live game in market yet where you might really burn your customers if you do a test like that. So it's the time to do it.
Would you say that the planning phase is mostly qualitative? I know you, in the matrix later in the paper, you differentiate between qualitative and quantitative. I'd imagine most of the stuff that's happening in the planning phase and even the development phase is qualitative research. We're not really able to run a large sample test when we're planning out the game design with six designers.
Definitely. For now, it's qualitative. One thing I'd note there, and I briefly touch on it in the very end of the article, is like if we think about Gen AI or what has been done in games for a very long time, like procedural content generation and building bots that can play the game, they can also propose and develop new content, and even assess how this content would be received by players, given their preferences as observed in telemetry. If we think about that kind of technology, as we may be able to infuse it more into the planning and development phases, we might actually get something that's more similar to quantitative experimentation also, where you simulate basically like a player landscape given on personas you believe you'll encounter in the market, etc. I mean, this is complete future talk. I don't think we're there yet, but I think there could be stuff happening around that in the future. I think it's really exciting. But yeah, generally for now, planning and development is, yeah. And then quantitative experimentation to mirror that is once you actually have decent sample sizes, which could happen, start happening during soft launch, when you put your game out in 3 countries and you start having 10,000 users or whatever, that's when you can start doing quantitative experimentation, which is really what people think of as A/B testing, I'd say. And then you do the typical statistical analysis of that. If you have rich data and sufficient sample sizes, of course, also start understanding treatment effect heterogeneity and like personalization potential for different experiments. But yeah, this is already leaning too far. But the idea with this matrix was simply to say, hey, we take a key concept from marketing that's being used to understand how firms can interface with customers. And frankly, like experimentation is about learning from customers, right? We just had it either both in the qualitative and in the quantitative variant. It's really about learning from customers about the market. So yeah, we take this marketing mix and we marry it with a game development process to then look at what are now in each of these cells, key tasks that have some relevance for experimentation. And so one thing I want to call out in that regard is, for example, if you look in the planning phase in the price, like price row, I have pricing and monetization model there. This is not something that people would commonly think about, but I think this is why this framework can be somewhat useful. So even when you decide if you're going to go free to play or not, you're already making a decision with major implications for how you'll be able to leverage experimentation in the future. Because only with free to play will you be sure to get the sample sizes to iterate on free players and then to also really iterate on conversion and then paying players, etc., which you may never get to if you decide for a premium monetization model. And yeah, this is the idea of this matrix. Like, what are the different tasks that become relevant in these stages that have something to do with how your experimentation strategy will unfold?
I guess part of my gripe with that is the pricing model, you have it over here on the far left in the planning phase, but that could totally evolve as the game evolves. Like, you might have a game concept, like it's going to be this type of game. You develop it and you find out your original hypothesis was off and there's a different part of the game that's fun. As the game evolves in the development cycle, your pricing and monetization model might totally change. And so you probably don't want to lock yourself in that early in the planning cycle.
And this isn't saying now you make this decision, this is set in stone, but it's like the point in time when you first want to think about it. And sure, if you then later decide to change your pricing model because you think it's going to lead to a much more appealing game, then you should just be aware that will impact your experimentation strategy as well. That's really the point of it. It's not like you need to tie this down then and that's it.
Or think this is the experimentation guide to game development. Where does experimentation come in there? That's just idea or ideation, right? It's just, oh, what are the different ways that we can do this? It's more of a design question than it is like an experiment question. So like with the matrix, we're talking about deciding on a monetization model from the very, very beginning. How's there any sort of like experimentation or even like iteration that could be done there? I understand how we can test our game design at that stage, and there's experimentation there. You have two different builds, you test the two different builds. What kind of experimentation happens at section 1.6?
There's no experimentation happening at that point. It's more about that you should think about it because it will impact your experimentation strategy and how you will be able to leverage. So really this matrix is like for strategic decision making on your experimentation program. Mm-hmm. And this is super useful questions because I think I'm so much coming at this from this point of view of a business strategist who's thinking now, like, how do we apply experimentation here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this would be how to think about it there.
There's two different kind of vectors that I'm thinking about with respect to games. There's where are you in your development pipeline? And then where are you, or timeline? And then where are you, like, on the spectrum of games? Are you, like, a premium first person? Are you God of War or are you Candy Crush? And you have this like spectrum where Candy Crush and God of War are on the opposite ends. So with respect to monetization, is there any, what kind of experimentation is a premium game able to do? Especially when it comes to monetization, right? We can think of a million, we know how King was running experiments left, right, and center on their platform, but how does that, that's like God of War is the example I use. what kind of experiment can we run there? We're not doing price optimization for premium games in this industry. We know that. That's $60-$70. Those are your two options.
Yeah, so what comes to mind is ad monetization is still going to be something you want to probably optimize in a premium title. And the other thing is DLC or other content packs that you sell later on where you then want to do pricing and promotion testing. And then, of course, the maximizing fun or revealed fun, I guess, as engagement or playtime through dynamic difficulty adaptation or different matching systems that decide like how the social structures in the game evolve can be impactful areas for experimentation, also in premium titles, I think.
Can we flip the whole model on its head, right? What if we took a different approach and we went inductive here, and instead we asked, when in these stages, planning, development, launch, and post-release, do gaming companies do experimentation right now? And if we were to take that approach, I think what I see here is that I don't agree with the paper that you were talking about earlier. Gaming companies do thousands of experiments. Literally, that is true. Let me ask you this. If you were to compare your time in gaming to, let's say, your time at Meta, which I know you were also in traditional tech, don't you think like we get a lapse in terms of the amount of experiments that are run, let's say, per ad count? Because AAA gaming couldn't experiment their way out of a fucking box. You think seeing someone at Blizzard is running experiments? Give me a break, right? That ain't happening. Call of Duty does run experiments, but I think the amount of experiments they would run probably could fit on maybe both of your hands per year. I look at tech, they're running hundreds, thousands of experiments. Feels like we're behind in this, not ahead. Not to say there isn't something that we could learn, but it feels like we're actually worse at this.
I think Julian's at the section six. All right, I'll let you talk about it, but he talks about like why they're sometimes hard in games.
Yeah,
I get that, but I feel like if we were to jump to that. So one of the things that you say is you talk about the challenges here at the end of the paper. And when I read a lot of these challenges, sometimes I understand them as notes about like causal chain in gaming. Makes a ton of sense. When you run an experiment, there's all these causal events that you could trigger because it's an omnidirectional experience, right? Like you do something, then something else happens, then you do something. And so you're disrupting a chain of events. Totally makes sense. That doesn't happen in other forms of experimentation sometimes. But there are other times that I feel like some of these criticisms are ones I hear a lot about experimentation in gaming. And it's one Bill Grosso talked about when he was on too, about the objections people make. For instance, disrupting the player experience. Experiments do not break immersion or alienate players. Use subtle incremental changes for testing. Like this strikes at the opposite end of everything I'm doing, at least to the experimentation group. Like we're trying to take as big of swings as possible. We don't want there to be subtle changes. We want there to be big and loud changes, exactly to what you were just saying, right? We were just talking about this, right?
Yeah, but
you want to take big swings to see what the effect is in the supply chain, right? You want it to be visible.
The big swings were for qualitative experimentation, but we're not yet in market. So I think...
Isn't it more valuable to run this in market? If when you run it in market, the effect size are even more important and the connection to bottom line revenue is even more concrete.
Well, that depends really on how you set up. And I think I mentioned it also in this... at some point. But so if you have a portfolio of games, right, let's say you're running 20 live games and some of them are hugely successful, sure, you might be able to run some pretty drastic experiments on the smaller ones and try to transfer learnings to the bigger ones. But if you really just have one or two big games out there that are driving all the revenue for your company, you probably want to go incremental. Those are things that you should definitely think about. And especially when it comes to gaming communities are can be very tight knit and they're rightfully sensitive when it comes to being treated unfairly. So I think this is just what this point wants to highlight. Be aware of this going on and then think about it, given the specific setup of your company, what makes most sense.
I mean, there's a retention risk, right? If you like shock the system, think about how pissed off people get when there's like a slight rebalance in like Overwatch or something. Everybody freaks out because this weapon is now doing 10% more damage than it was yesterday. Maybe that risk isn't as large as I think it would be.
I don't think it is. There was this famous experiment. Again, let's think about taking this from the inductive approach. So there was this famous experiment that was published on Kotaku that Zynga ran in one of their racing games.
PSR Racing 2. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, CSR Racing 2, the Fast and Furious car, if you remember
yes.
this.
Yes, $5, 15, and 35, I think they did.
Yes, oh my God, your memory is a true experimentation gaming pro. If you remember, that article got leaked on Kotaku, but okay, so what? This is what I don't understand. Like, prices change all the time. Like, you can look at Amazon prices. They change daily.
Yeah.
Why do we give a shit about the fact that players notice this? This is a normal part of living in a digital economy. This is happening to us on every other platform.
I'll jump in here. First, on Amazon, they actually used to price discriminate based on your, like, tracking cookies, and they stopped because they had so much flack for it. They do change the prices, but everyone sees the same price, right? And there's other ways they, like, subtly price discriminate indirectly. But the main issue I see here is for the experiment validity. When there are social spillover effects, you can't just assume, oh, treatment effect A, treatment effect B, here's the delta, here's the impact, right? Because information spillovers between A and B groups affect the results. For example, if you price differently, if nobody sees, realizes the prices are different, then okay, the experiment works. But if the people talk to their friends, oh, you got $10? Oh, you got $35? Oh, huh. And it changes their evaluation, changes their behavior. And all of a sudden, the effect you're measuring is not the true effect you're trying to isolate. The more social a game is, the more people have community forums where they talk about it, the more they talk about it with their friends, the more multiplayer it is, the more likely these social spillover effects are to occur.
So it's the social aspect of gaming that makes it difficult, because you don't really have that. I'm not like talking to my friends about the prices they're seeing on Amazon.
And social, and relatedly, the emotional aspect. And I think this is also why you can say it's fine if people get really upset about that car being priced at $5, $15, $35, but that's not really what you want if you want to be known as a customer-centric company, right? This car is like a highly emotional object for somebody playing CSR racing. I was a very avid CSR racing player, both 1 and 2. And if you just take this thing that the whole game is about and change the price so drastically by factor 7, this is going to upset people, and people are going to churn. They're literally not going to give you a wallet.
Weren't you the guy who ran the price promotion paper that did exactly what you just suggested, though, and radically changed the price of goods? We saw the same thing in the King paper. To be fair, the King paper was about quantity discounting.
Yes.
So is that what is? So do you think David Nelson gets away with it because they do quantity discounting rather than price discounting? Is that the suggestion we should take away?
So we discussed that paper and my price promotion paper at length in the previous recording we did. So the quantity discount thing is super interesting, but you only really reach the people who buy packs that are larger than the small one. So that whole experiment, that whole treatment doesn't even reach all the
intensive
players.
Intensive, extensive margin. Yeah. I think that completely makes sense. I think that was a fascinating conversation we had about that.
Yeah, but just on my paper then, and this goes back to what Eric said, like Amazon only does dynamic pricing. They change the price over time, and they do that quite substantially, right? Like by factor 2 or whatever, but they don't charge different prices at the same time to consumers in the same geolocation, where I think that's usually at the country level. And so importantly, in this price promotions paper we discussed that I have, we also really only changed prices over time. When there was some targeting in terms of what discount pack they were targeted with the players, that's fair. But it was more actually looking at what happens if we dynamically change prices over time and really do that in a fully randomized experiment over the long time. And then basically we just saw that the intertemporal substitution is much lower than we would have expected based on existing research. Sorry, but just long chat.
No, that's fair, but those weren't subtle changes.
No, that's true. But no, they weren't. Yeah, that's fair.
Players could talk about it, right?
Yeah, and we did though.
Did you find that?
So we monitored the forums and customer service very closely, both here and honestly in all offer targeting experiments I've run, we tend to do that. And there's also certain things you can do in terms of how you design a starter pack or bundles that you don't upset people as much necessarily. But yeah, I think that's crucial to monitor that, because
I've actually found, Eric, the opposite to be true. It's not that players are pissed that they want the offer, right? Because this is sometimes what gets lost, like in all these conversations about price discrimination that I thought Will Grosso was really good at bringing up, which is that most of this is about cutting price, right? It's not about increasing price. Like movie discounts, for matinees for seniors, all this is about decreasing price and getting to more elastic groups. And it's usually the case that like when you offer this, players go to customer support and they're like, oh, I heard about this sale my friend got. I wanted this. I don't want this offer. Like they want the... It's not anger.
They're angry that they didn't get... They're jealous they didn't get the good offer.
Very much true. I think like the Zynga offer just stands in really interesting contrast to that, because that did get virtual. It was Kotaku. Take it for what it's worth. But I guess there is some sense that like prices are sticky. I think nominal prices are sticky. I think shadow prices are far less sticky, if that makes sense. And I think quantity discounting is almost a shadow price. Like, you are changing price per unit, but I think the nominal prices really matter. I think consumers really benchmark on that.
What do you mean shadow prices are less sticky?
What is a shadow price?
For instance, if you change the difficulty of a match 3 game, or let's say this, let's say you decrease the amount of goal or the amount of boosters that are given away in a match 3 game for free. In some sense, you're increasing the expected price of a booster by giving away less for free. And so that could be one way that on the supply side, you're effectively changing the price of a booster. Or if you change difficulty, you're also changing the price of levels, right? Because in a match level, you can conceive that players are paying to progress by buying extra moves and extra boosters. And so if you increase difficulty, you're increasing the price of a level. But again, that isn't an explicit price. It's a shadow price.
Huh. I thought a shadow price was the marginal cost. I thought the shadow price was the opportunity cost of, because there's also a shadow price in the context of like classic optimization problems, like when you're solving Lagrangian, like you literally have a shadow price on lambda, but.
Yes.
Is that the same thing that you're talking about?
No.
How the shadow price is more prices. Elastic. The shadow price is more elastic. I'm like trying to wrap my head around
what I mean by that is that consumers are less sensitive to changes in non-explicit prices than they are into explicit prices. So to give you an example, like if we rearranged a grocery store and we move like the milk farther back, that's a shadow price to get the milk.
I see what you're saying.
So when you say more or less, you mean like you can change shadow prices more easily without upsetting people. Like
this. Exactly. And I think that's what the Zynga versus King experiment would show is that even if you just do one step removed, right, it was an explicit price, right? The amount of gold bars was explicit when you bought those SKUs. Yeah. But most people price in USD, like those nominal prices, the actual real amount of dollars that leave your wallet is what consumers anchor on.
Yeah, dude, I totally agree with that. I think actually a lot of these you can design around by using shadow prices. So for example, I mentioned this in the show notes. Imagine you wanted to test a progression rate change, plus minus 10%. If you change it so that some people get 90%, 90 XP per level and some people get 110 XP per level, players will see it, they'll notice, they'll talk about it. But if you change the odds of a rare loot drop from, let's say, 9% to 11%, they won't be able to tell as much, right? And so you don't have these social spillovers, you don't have these price anchoring and transparency. Because it's a shadow price change, you can conduct the experiment without...
Maybe that's an advantage of pricing everything in time, like Pokemon TCG is doing. Everything's a shadow price there.
Julian, I really like in your paper how you talk about these problems and propose solutions. I think... As someone reading the paper, I'm like, okay, yeah, there's all these spaces where I could experiment, but what should I be doing? And I really thought this what to do sections were pretty strong, or common pitfalls, that sort of thing.
Thank you. One thing I was thinking as I was finishing the paper up is, okay, who's the audience for this? Because if it's somebody that's at a company that has a million users, they probably already have a data science group or experimentation arm that's already doing this stuff. Maybe not. Maybe it's a PM and maybe they're looking for more juice. They're looking for meat. Okay, where can we push and prod? But I think a lot of people who are reading this kind of stuff, and honestly, a few of the people that I saw at the mini summit last year at GDC, they were more startup-y, very small companies. And I remember one of the kind of complaints that I heard from two individuals actually that were at the mini summit. They were like, we're much earlier in our development phase and we have far fewer players, so we're not able to run these massive long-term experiments. We're just trying to improve our monetization at a much smaller scale. I'm curious, do you feel like this paper addresses that person, and how does somebody with a smaller player base, you know, how do they experiment? They clearly do not have the statistical power to be able to actually run meaningful statistical tests. Can they still experiment?
Good question. So they surely can experiment, but I don't know if this paper specific or this framework would be super useful to them other than an overview of what's possible and thinking through the areas where they might be able to do something. So if you look at the matrix, and I think, they'd be in the post-release phase and maybe realize that price and offer personalization could be pretty impactful. They might not be doing it yet, so that could be a starting point then for them to dive into adopting experimentation for that use case. For the audience, I think I said to about that in the beginning, but I think it's more for, yeah, like business people who run the strategy of a company to just challenge their data science and analytics team on what's happening in the different areas. Or if you want to install an experimentation roadmap as a game publisher, you would probably want to consult this. Or if you, yeah, you need a certain level of ambition and scale, I think, to be making use of this. But even if you're a small indie, I think still just glancing over it and seeing, hey, what are we actually doing? Did we do marketability testing for our creatives that we want to use in game and stuff like that could be quite useful, because it might not have occurred to you because you only did game design in university and didn't think about marketability testing. I think even there, this might have some value. But overall, it's a bit of a work in progress still. And the audience, yeah, I think is in many different areas. Coming back to what Phil said about the maturity of experimentation also in gaming compared to tech. And it's probably true that the large tech companies run more experiments than the large game companies, at least the more traditional game companies. But still, the experimentation programs that you have in gaming are super impressive. And just like even coming back to the challenges we discussed, right? Because the systems are so complex and nuanced, you actually have this richness to play with that is just like phenomenal and interesting. And one company I was thinking about specifically is actually Netflix, because they are known, right, and very open also about their experimentation programs that they use on the streaming side of things. And they are also, as we all know, a pretty big game publisher by now. And I actually don't know that they are, or like what they're doing on the gaming side specifically. But
nothing. They're doing absolutely nothing interesting. Don't waste your time.
Wow. That's harsh. You mean in experimentation or generally?
Netflix?
Yeah, they're not doing what they should be doing.
Yeah,
that's a whole
yeah, I think Netflix is a big burning pile of money.
Oh, that was my game for the day. I was going to talk about.
Yeah, we'll
I've been playing Netflix games.
Maybe I'm wrong. Chris, tell me I'm
no,
wrong.
No, it was fucking horrible. No, oh, they're okay. Terrible. No, it's just they're an annoying intermediary. But that's besides the point. I don't know what kind of experimentation they could possibly be doing. Like
they're probably doing like placement and recommendation experiments like all over the place, the way they do with their shows. I don't think they're doing in-game experiments. Yeah, so Netflix does tons of placement experimentation, the ordering of the rows and which things are at the front and the back. And I'm sure they're doing that with the placement of the Netflix games in their apps. Mm-hmm. Don't think they're doing in-game experimentation. They're actually modifying the games themselves. And no. To what Julian was saying earlier, that's where a lot of the interesting stuff with experimentation in games comes from. There's so many more systems and levers and incentives and knobs to turn. But I'm pretty sure Netflix is just buying HTML5 games off like on the cheap and just like inserting them into their.
It's really a distribution platform. It feels more like Steam for mobile, because I've never seen a Netflix game on my console or on my TV. I've only ever seen it mobile. The only reason I remembered that my Netflix account had games associated with it is because I opened up the mobile app to try and download some shows while I was traveling. And then I saw a few games and I had to download those games from the App Store via Netflix. And then I had to log into my account, so I couldn't even play them on the plane because I didn't have Wi-Fi. So it's just like an absolute fucking shit show. But they have some good games on there. Bloons Tower Defense 6, which I guess is premium. My experience was like very, I was like, why do I have Netflix for this? I'm just downloading these off the internet or off the App Store anyway. It's very weird.
This is the thing that I think I was interested that Julian didn't talk about in the paper, is this whole idea of experimentation for optimization, or almost as an engineering problem. And then I think experimentation as almost a Bayesian framework for updating your priors and almost discovering a new space, particularly like in the development phase. So like when I think about a lot of tech experimentation, it's about a very defined problem and you're basically just trying to fill the content at the right time for the consumer. That is Facebook ads. That is also Netflix's algorithm. All these multi-arm bandits that you hear about, almost no gaming company is doing a multi-arm bandit where you're just throwing thousands of variants into a funnel and then seeing which one is the winner. Very few gaming companies are doing that, where this is like the go-to model for almost all tech companies to, let's say, pick the right thumbnail for you on Netflix or to recommend you the right amount of content. It's a very defined optimization problem. Let's run millions of these. It's an engineering problem. They've turned experimentation to engineering, whereas I don't think gaming companies do that a lot because there's so much more uncertainty with games. Like no one is doing experimentation to figure out how to make a particular creative product inside of Netflix. There's this big famous example of House of Cards coming from their algorithm that people liked David Fincher and people liked Kevin Spacey. But the director for House of Cards, David Fincher, do you think he was looking at fucking experiments on the Netflix platform? No, there was no role that experiments played in him coming up with a creative medium. And I think that's not the case in gaming, because there's this whole uncertainty about what you're building until you build it. And there's this famous quote from this Valve psychologist, Mike something or other, and he's on Twitter, and he actually just left Valve. And one of the things he said is that we see our playtests as ways to validate our hypothesis about our games. And so to me, it's about having a model. Like, this is where I think it's really important, is what is your model about like how this game works? And then how can we use experiments to challenge or to redefine that model? Like, Julian, we were talking about match, right? Like, I think to run an effective match experiment, to really figure that out, like, you need a falsification model. You need to do science. Like, you can't talk about experimentation without science. And I don't think you can talk about science without falsification or theory. And so, like, even when we go back and we think about, like, where are games actually doing experiments, I think a lot of it is falsification. Have you ever heard of Geek Lab?
What?
You would fucking love Geek Lab. You should talk to them. So what they do is they create fake store pages to test creative for mobile games. So if you want to build a match game, they'll test like a bunch of different fake, absolute, but real app store pages. And so you can measure impressions and see down the funnel, it's not just people clicking on ads, but it's also clicking fake store pages, right? Like, how much of the funnel can I test and see what CPIs end up like? And that to me starts with a theory about what is the product that's going to resonate with consumers? What is the creative? And the only time, I mean, it's not multi-arm bandit, but hyper casual does this really well, right? Like, they'll take a core and they'll reskin it 100 different times and see which is the creative that pairs best with the core gameplay. That stuff is a little more engineering-y, but I think a lot of the fun experimentation comes from the model.
Yeah, and this creative stuff also is an area though where game companies can use bandits also, right? I say, like, part of why bandits aren't as common maybe in gaming is actually the complex nature of them and the challenges we discussed, right, around engaged communities, the complex systems, the long-term effects that matter. If you actually go over to the Game Data Pros blog, so gamedatapros.com/blog, we have a case study on there for a bandit experiment we ran with a gaming company around creative optimization. And we actually had some interesting findings doing that.
I want to touch on something on that note. What Julian mentioned earlier, which is about the qualitative, the low sample size, just big impact. You're not really trying to measure anything explicitly. You're just, I made this change. Are people wowed? Did they have a strong reaction or not? Do you consider that scientific, Phil? If it's like, I made headshots. When you shoot someone in the head, there's an explosion of blood and it plays a sound effect and I have people play it. And if they react strongly to that, then I think it's a good thing. And if they don't, then it's a bad thing. Is that an experiment? Or?
Yeah. I don't think that's science as we've generally understood it. I don't think you need a randomized controlled trial to do science. And we know this because there's so many parts of science that have come with non-testable hypothesis, non-experimentation results, especially in physics too. So I don't think we can boil down science to just that. I would say having a theory and going out and trying to falsify it, to me, is the most important part here. And I think the gold standard of randomized controlled trials is one way to falsify. And I think it gives you a higher level of confidence than what you just suggested. But the designer would have a theory. I think this is something that's going to resonate with players. It's not really well-defined, but I think you can say, okay, did this resonate with players? Okay, what's my strategy to figure out whether or not this resonated with players? Okay, I'm going to talk with them afterwards. Don't get me wrong. That is so rife with the 50 million things that we could all name off the top of our head, but they had a strategy beforehand and they sought to influence the variable and they try to measure it afterwards. That to me is a scientific loop. It's just a sloppy set of tools to get it done.
And do you feel like the people who are being unscientific about it, they're not being explicit enough about their initial hypothesis, not being explicit about what would falsify their theory?
I don't think they have a model, right? They don't have a model of what makes this tick, or they haven't made the model explicit. There's this, I just know it when I see it, which is the biggest load of absolute cop-out, crock, cock of shit I've ever heard in my life. Like, it's avoiding like putting down what as the thing that drives this game. Like, I think this is what economists are really good at, is making explicitly falsifiable theories. And so, again, it doesn't have to be in math. It has to be like, I think this is what matters. And okay, how could we test this? And I think development is a good way to do that. Playtests are a good way to do that. Like that quote from Valve is, oh, I think this is what makes the game work. So to give you one example, like Deadlock from Valve, right? Recently, it's a MOBA. It's from Ice Frog, who did Dota. And so there's so many different components in that game. But I would be disappointed if Valve didn't, for instance, do a playtest where they took out a major feature of the game, the in-game shop. For, let's say, if you played MOBAs before, you know that there's this in-game shop, you collect gold. Like, they should be ripping out major features like that in their core gameplay and then figuring out or feeling how that affects all these subsequent causal events. All right. And that tells you a lot about that feature. Like, that to me is a really, it's not a randomized control tile, but it is an experiment. I don't know, Julian, does this fit in your framework? Is this a cop out?
I wanted to say is at the experimentation group, the work you do there, we should do a session or you should do a session describing some of it. I'd actually love to see like how you, exactly what you just said, like how you bring models and falsifiable hypotheses to the clients and make sure that at least, okay, great. That leads to better experimentation outcomes.
We have Dave back on. He's the real master. He followed a lot of your advice, right? You can do radical changes, but at King, they were funneling the experiments from the games that were dead, that no one cared about anymore. Like, that to me is a really solid strategy. I wish more firms did. You have a new version of something, test on the old one. Test on the ones that you don't care about, but make it more radical. So he did that. So to give you another example of a company that could really take your advice, EA and FIFA, they have yearly versions of their game. Why is FIFA not testing on like FIFA 09, a radical experiment that could affect 26? Those games have sizable player bases.
Yeah.
2 just came out. Why not experiment on Arturo 1 player?
I think there will be people from EA at the mini summit during GDC. You should talk to them about it.
I sent Andrew Wilson an email once about this.
Phil, I want to go back to this idea of scientific method during the design phase. It sounded like you were saying, like, when you're in the design phase, when the designer's designing, they're not using the scientific method because they don't have a hypothesis that they're technically testing. They're really just searching.
Just to be clear, good ones do.
Okay, so I guess 2 questions. First one, what does that hypothesis look like? Are they testing mechanics? Should I add this mechanic or not add this mechanic? Does this make the game better? And then the second thing is, if we were to look at two designers that were identical except for the methodology, one is using this scientific method and one is looking for the North Star, they're gonna know it when they see it. Do you think that the outcomes are really going to be that different? Assuming that the original kind of like concept remains the same for the game.
Well, let me take the first one, which is that I think it depends on the discipline, right? So let's give an example of like when I was on Battlefield, there were level designers. And level designers obviously want to maximize player engagement and retention and feedback about the maps being good or bad. And so one of the things that you might see is, okay, there's a lot of sniping going on. The sheriff snipers that are being selected is higher than it otherwise would be on other maps. And a lot of players aren't finding that experience enjoyable. They're getting picked from 100 yards away. Okay, we're going to change the geometry of the map such that sniping is less favorable. So we might put in more hills or more cover. And so we're going to go into the playtest and we're going to see if there's more or less sniping based on the changes we made. You're not necessarily running like a true experiment. Like, you could call an experiment if you did it on a Tuesday and then on a Thursday playtest, it was different, and then you're comparing the data. That's not a true experiment as we think about it. It's certainly not a randomized control trial, but like, you had a theory, which is that, well, I think snipers are not making this map enjoyable or getting a lot of player feedback, and that by me making this change to the map, I will change the amount of snipers that are being used. That to me is a scientific loop. Whether or not we use the word experiment with it,
yeah,
I'll leave that to semantics and different philosophers, mm-hmm. but I think the science piece is really important.
Yeah, it's funny because we're working on a free-to-play version of our game right now, and we're just basically testing it. The cool thing about this is we can launch this game on a side net basically for free. So we're going to have the full game. It's just going to be a completely different version. So we're exploring, how would we redesign the whole entire system, all the numbers, using a free-to-play framework versus the premium framework? And it's literally a team of 3 people, me and 2 engineers. And it's like, what's the most efficient way? And I'm getting really frustrated because I'm struggling to find the most efficient way to experiment with new, okay, we've tested these stats out. We didn't quite like them. There were some issues with this one. Trying to converge to a semi-decent equilibrium as quickly as possible. And it's really just been, I would say, probably closer to a bandit approach than testing one piece at a time. Or I don't even know if it would be considered a bandit, but basically we're not like testing one mechanic at a time. We're throwing basically entire different worlds together. Okay, let's compare world A to world B. We prefer B, go down B. now we want to compare C to D. Okay, we prefer C, and just keep searching for the optimal. It's almost like a sorting algorithm. It's an interesting situation that I'm in where it's, man, how do we converge to the optimal, at least close to an optimal, a local optimum, as quickly as possible without having to waste a whole bunch of resources? You know, we've got like team testers.
Let me ask you, what are the experiments, Julian, that you think are not being run in games that should be run right now?
One area I'd say is in social matching, actually. I think many game companies rely on self-selection of players into the kind of teams or groupings they want to find. I think that could be supported by algorithmic intervention more so through smart designs to make sure that to really optimize also for some long-term outcome, like a balanced overall global leaderboard or whatever. I think there's stuff there that could be done better, or not necessarily better, but where there's opportunities to really move the needle in the good direction in terms of skill development for players through that engagement and through that, of course, also monetization ultimately. That's one of the key areas, I think, where I would love to see more.
What about on the marketing side?
I think a lot of good stuff is already happening.
So hold on, you're going to give me this whole matrixy, and you're not going to tell me that you don't think we're missing out along this matrixy? I haven't seen a single experiment at the planning phase.
Okay, so one thing I would find interesting, but it's a bit complex. So there's this idea of satiation that has been proposed. It's also intuitive, but it's also been in some marketing papers recently on the monetization of apps and app-based games. And the idea is as a player plays or a user uses an app, they satiate with that experience, right? It's either about you read articles or you satiate with playing these game levels and so on. How to optimally manage, it even goes back to the flow ideas, et cetera, we discussed earlier, but it's a bit of a different conceptual angle. And so the idea would be you actually don't want a player to satiate, right? You want to maybe even disrupt their play experience before they satiate with the game. So what I've been wondering, and actually I've been discussing with Chris Ryan, who we talked about earlier, who has a paper in management science on level design, is this idea, can it be beneficial to disrupt the continued engagement of players to manage satiation and increase their likelihood to come back later? And probably this is actually also going to be vastly heterogeneous across different players. And I think even the data that we get, like the behavioral telemetry we get from players, would be quite helpful in doing effective personalization on that. So this is an area where I'd love to run an experiment, and it would be something like maybe...
It's a cake eating problem, right? It's the dynamic optimization cake eating problem. Do you eat the cake now or do you spread it out?
Yeah, and then, but here, because this is the awesome thing about game design, right? Or game making, you can cut off the cake. You can keep the player from eating the cake through interventions like timers or a life system where they run out of lives and so on. And see, this is also interesting because I feel like life systems specifically used to be super popular, even for monetization, but I don't know that they are anymore. You would know that better than me.
I would say the arcade monetization was interesting, right? Because the arcade is the first form of MTX, I would argue, of like uncapped marginal cost. And you go back and you listen to the early stories of how much these arcade machines were making, and it was an incredible amount of money, right? The problem, I would argue, is that the amount of money you make per unit of time is relatively fixed. So if I insert a quarter, it basically buys me an expected 30 minutes of engagement. And I think we've unlocked how to make that even higher. If you go to 4X, I could spend $10,000 in one day just buying peace shields or just buying troops that are consumables and that they'll die and they regenerate. And then I spend to speed up timers that generate more troops. But I think we found that's just like a more interesting lever than holding back lives. And holding back lives, the problem with holding back lives or holding back engagement is that it's a tax on every other form of monetization, right? So in match three, if I make money on extra moves and you start to make lives a strong component of rationing, that means I have less attempts, and less attempts means less gold spent, and less gold spent means less revenue. And so I think we've just figured out that the amount we can make per hour is much better if we had more hours, right? Like it solves that.
But let me ask you this then. What, in your opinion, would be an effective way to manage satiation?
So I don't necessarily agree with the theory. Oh. I would argue that I think players satiate themselves. So for instance, I definitely think this is a testable hypothesis, right? What is a live system and then not having a live system in a match game do, holding everything else constant? That to me is a very clear experiment that I think would help resolve this. And I think for your theory to hold true to be the case that if I intervene in ration, it's more effective. I would argue that you would need to show that the one with the lives has a higher long run retention. We know it'll reduce attempts, right, per day. That's the whole point. It should do that. But I don't think that would be the case. I think you would still probably win by players just naturally buying down their diminishing returns each day and then naturally coming back. And I think that's the equilibrium games have settled at, free-to-play games.
Okay.
That would be what I throw down on this one.
Yeah, I would love to run that experiment, though. So maybe, this is also a call out to the listeners. If anybody wants to work together on running this experiment, please reach out.
I think this also has another dimension. So there's the player progression one we were talking about in this rationing problem. But I would say this is also something that AAA studios face all the time, which is that I have a bunch of content in a locker. I don't know if I should dump all that content on D1 or whether or not I should spread that content out over time. And so that, I think, is very similar to the problem I just mentioned, but I would almost challenge my own thinking on that. I do think that sometimes you want to spread out content like that. I think you need to change your way you think about games. I think you need to introduce a dating model for that. It's almost if you have a bunch of compatible mates that are introduced to you at one time, right? You can't really satiate each one. And sometimes you get into these, okay, we're going to stop here. But I would say,
I want to hear that. You get into these what?
You get into these different models that may have different explanatory powers and different equilibrium.
I feel like whenever Phil gets embarrassed, he just says model.
Hey, we're at the hour. It was great having you, Julian. No, guys, our guest today has been Dr. Julian. Dr. Julian, where can we learn more about your work?
Yeah, give us some shout outs, some links.
I guess shill.
To sign up for the mini summit at GDC, go to gamedatapros.com. There should be an overlay popping up where you can register. About me, LinkedIn is good, or just Google me. I have a personal website where you can find my research also. And then Google Scholar.
We'll link that out in the show notes.
Yeah, Google Scholar is pretty good because it has all my papers if you're interested.
But cool. Thanks, Julian.
Outro music.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We should teach this to our children. Economics is major. Everyone has to major in economics. Number one, for personal survival. Economics is major.